Blog Talk Radio.
There it is.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
This is MJ Network. This is your host, Fran Lewis. And this is going to be fantastic, absolutely fantastic. MJ stands for Marsha Joyce, my sister, who I miss, and I think I'm going to keep her alive in my network. And we have the author of Napa Noir here. What more could you want? So let me give you a little taste of. I'll fix my Amazon review later. Maybe I'll make them happier. An orchestra leader takes the musicians to new heights each time they play a piece in front of an audience. The conductor makes sure that the players are in position, that they follow his hands and commands, that the rhythm and sounds of the piece are perfectly heard by the audience. Dan Rath, a reporter for a major paper, is witness to a perfectly orchestrated and well-planned murder. But the victims never realize that they have been manipulated, and the end result are two deaths and someone hiding this behind the scenes that would eventually regal in his perfect plan's outcome. And we'll learn more from, I hope I say this right, Peter Eigenstedt. So, good morning. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm just peachy today.
Okay.
So, this was interesting. It's a different kind of book. So, creating a book on wine industry, what led you to write about the Napa Valley? Because I find that really fascinating.
Well, there's a couple of things. One is, as you may have noticed, my background is in journalism, and I've written quite a bit of number of nonfiction books. So all of my work, even the fiction, tends to be grounded in fact and real incidents. And what I've done is, I come across a certain event, and it puzzles me as to why something like that would happen, especially a strange crime. And in this particular case, I was reading about a murder in a vineyard in near Sonoma, California, Napa, Sonoma area, and I was just amazed that when I read the descriptions of the crime, in which a vineyard owner killed one of his investors, and then was chased by the police and ended up being cornered in a, forested area near Napa, and then died in a shootout with the police. And this prompted me to, I began asking the question, what in the world would somebody do that for? I mean, most people, certainly people who are in the wine world, hold, Northern California, the Napa, Sonoma area, as in a kind of ideal situation where, what a wonderful life it would be to have a vineyard and all the good food and wine and good climate, et cetera. It'd be like the pinnacle of existence. And it just puzzled me as to why in the world somebody would resort to such violence in the midst of an idyllic setting like that. And that's what launched me on the story. And the second part of it is that I'm a former resident of San Francisco, and my brother lived there for quite a long time, and so I had the opportunity to visit quite often. And after having lived there, and I've always liked California wines, and actually wines around the world. I've traveled quite a bit, and one thing led to another, and I thought, I felt like I had enough background and knowledge of that area to give it the sense of reality that I like to try to put into my fiction. And so when the two things came together, I started outlining a story, and it resulted in Napa Noir.
I loved it. And it was one of the few books
that.
I didn't know what I was getting, you know, what I was going to read. And I said, oh my God, this is interesting, because I don't drink wine, but I love the wine country. So how did you create this murder scene at the beginning, and why did you take out both of those people, Ling and Morrison? Not that they didn't deserve it. Seriously.
That's a good question. You know, other readers have pointed out the fact that I kind of turned the traditional format of whodunit kind of upside down, because at the very first chapter, you know who did it or who done it,
mm-hmm.
as they say, and who the victim is. And but what I wanted to do with, like I was saying before with this crime, I decided to open up the book with a dramatic scene to kind of set the stage and pique people's interest or readers' interest in it. And so I thought I would open up with a shooting scene and then bring in my main character, who's a journalist, who solves the mystery, the question as to why something heinous crime like this would occur. And so that's what the story is about. It's not so much who done it, but as to why was it done, and who, you know, and as you know, without giving any spoiler, you know that, as it turns out, the people that were behind the crime are not the ones you suspect.
I know. That's what really got me. So, how does wine critic Dan Rath get involved, and why? And what is a wine critic? Because I don't drink wine. I don't drink anything. But I used to like wine Zinfandel, and I know that's not the best wine in the world. And why is his column in danger? Yeah, I know. I have relatives that think they know, but they really don't know. They think they know, but they don't know. Seriously.
Yeah. Well, that's the reason I got into this was that one of the things that, you know, having been a journalist my whole life, I'm very disappointed in watching the slow demise of newspapers and news writing around the world. And I guess a demise really isn't the right word. I think what we're going through in the news business is a transition, you know, away from print into more digital news and in video and digital. And and I think we're going through a transition. But here we have a main character who has been a victim of downsizing, and despite doing good investigative work, investigative reporting, which I think is, you know, some of the most important reporting that's being done, that it's that he's gone from a, you know, major metro paper, you know, which I modeled after the San Francisco Chronicle, to working for something a little bit smaller and local. But my main character is a former investigative reporter, and he's been assigned to write kind of business news about the wine business, and then, of course, do wine reviews and that kind of thing. So it's my main character has taken a, you know, definite step backwards in terms of the career path for a journalist. But what happens is when he comes across this murder, his, you know, excitement grows very quickly, because he realizes that there's probably an awful lot more to this story than meets the eye. It's just not a small crime story. And so he, you know, as an author, you know, you create a situation where you have to give your characters opportunities to do things and say things and go places. And so when he goes to the crime scene, he encounters, you know, being a good observer, he looks around and sees who's there, and then has to ask himself, why are these people here? And what is their interest in this event? And that's what launches him down the path toward the resolution of the story.
Well, it was scary, let me tell you. So he gets himself in trouble because he decides to dig further. How come? He's more like me. I mean, if I don't know something, I'm going to drive you crazy until I find the answer. So why does he decide? Yeah, I mean, that's why I liked him. And I do hope, I have to ask this question, I do hope that you're not done writing about him, that you're going to write more, because there's got to, I got to know more about this guy, and he's got to come back, right? Of course he does.
Oh, yeah. I've been discussing, you know, with my publisher about the sequel, and I outlined something, I mean, very, very broad terms, outlined something in my mind, but I'm going to send them to, place the sequel in Tuscany, which is another one of my favorite wine regions.
Oh, nice.
And I have now that you bring it up, what comes to mind is, like, this is, in fact, the first of a series that I have in my mind about having stories and mystery, you know, wine country mysteries set in wine regions around the world. And this, you know, it hasn't been a very hard and fast research trip, but it's been kind of more of an accidental discovery. I lived overseas quite a lot in my career, and and both my wife and I like to travel, you know, when it's possible or affordable. And so we've, you know, in the course of my life, I've lived in wine regions around the world, from one of our favorite places, of course, is Tuscany to visit. And but we've been to South America. In Argentina, it has a great, very strong wine industry, wine business in the town of Mendoza, which is set against the, you know, at the base of the Andes Mountains. But one of my other locations, which I like to talk about, which is a lot of fun that people, most people are unaware of, is the country of Armenia. And in one of my assignments, I spent quite a long time in Armenia, and Yerevan is the capital there. And people are familiar with the biblical story of the great flood and Noah. And Noah's ark, when Noah's ark landed, it landed on Mount Ararat. And to this day, it's inside the border of Turkey, on the far eastern border between Armenia and Turkey, is where Mount Ararat is. But to this day, the Turks refuse to let archaeological teams go up on the mountain to determine whether or not there's ruins that would prove the existence of Noah's Ark. But anyway, that's beside the point. The interesting, fun thing about the story about Armenia is that, according to the bold biblical story, the first thing that Noah did after the flood was plant a vineyard. And a couple of verses later, it says that then he got drunk. So I just thought it was fascinating, because when I lived in Armenia, my apartment overlooked, the balcony overlooked Mount Ararat. And the valley below that is called, of course, called the Ararat Valley, but it's covered with vineyards. And it's some of the oldest vineyards in the world there. And the wine industry there is very strong. The Armenians make a really good wine, although very few people know about it outside of Armenia. And so I know there's one of those little kinds of things where I've lived and visited in these areas has, you know, gave me the idea to do a series maybe of mysteries set around the world and these different wine regions that people may or may not be familiar with. And, you know, there's a lot of exotic locales, exotic personalities that that I can tap into. So, you know, to answer your question, yes, I plan a whole series around this, and I hope to take the readers to some well-known locations as well as some unknown locations.
And I hope so, too, because this was like one of your friends asked me to read this, right? Somebody asked me to read this?
Yeah, Charles Salzberg.
Charles Salzberg, yes. I interviewed him last week with Wes Clavin and Tim O'Mara. It was a riot. We had so much fun.
Yeah. Those are a couple of my favorite people. I've known Charles for a number of years. It's all been, you know, online because I was years back. I was, trying to launch my writing career. I sent a manuscript to him, and I was part of a workshop, and then he critiqued my manuscript and gave me very encouraging responses. So thanks to him, I've continued to write.
Maybe I should get him to do my next one. If I get 5 minutes to do it, I've got so many books inside, and then they're the ones that I don't know I have, that I didn't know I was going to get. And then I was very honored. New York Times author Terry Chames sent me her new book, the Samuel Craddock murder book. And I have this coming out January. And I'm saying, like, this is not fair because I like this character. It's coming out in January. There are 10 books that are coming out next month. Oh, well, they'll just have to wait.
Yeah.
And I decided to read that one. She flipped out. She said, you're kidding me. I go, no, I love this character. It's so cool. So who is Simon Grundy, and what role does he play in Morrison's business? He was not a very nice man.
Yeah, well, that's Simon Grundy's a secondary character, mm-hmm. but he's an important character because I needed somebody in the story who was a, a practitioner, I guess is the word I want to use, but somebody who in the wine business, but as an expert. And Simon Grundy, as my main character, Dante Rath, discovers, is kind of the brains behind the outfit. He's the one that knows about growing wine. He knows about harvesting wine. He knows all the ins and outs about the fermentation process, when to when wine should be picked and not picked, when they should ready to be bottled, all that stuff. And I needed that guy in there. And because my main character, you know, Dante, is a journalist, and as journalists were, I hate to say it, in most cases we're generalists. You know, we know a little bit about a lot of things. And it's kind of the fault of the business is that you're going from one story to the next, you know, day after day or week after week. So you don't, because of the pace of the news business, you don't have a lot of time to become a quote-unquote expert on anything. So I needed somebody in the story who was an expert. And his relationship with the victim, this Morrison, my bad guy, Morrison is kind of the money guy, and he hustles and generates the capital that's needed. But he has to, again, he partners up with this Simon Grundy, who's the wine expert, and the two of them actually have the business going. And so that's our. I had him. He plays a crucial, but like I said, secondary role. And once I had that established, then I was faced with the question of, you know, how do I handle him? Do I keep him around? How long do I keep him around? Does he die, or should he die, or should he not die? And those are the kind of questions that I had to wrestle with.
Well, I don't blame you. You killed off two people. We'll get into that right now.
Right.
Now, what if he, first of all, I found it very fascinating to learn about grapes and about wine and about bacteria and about what happens when the grapes are no good. And I looked it up, and I'm going like, this is really interesting. So what does he reveal about, learn about the grapes, and why steal grapes? How would that benefit him, and why did Ling stupidly give him $1 million and then want it back? Oh, well. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
That was interesting. That was that first scene. I said, oh, my God.
Yeah, well, that's what, that's part of the, to me, it was a fascinating part of the of writing the book, was doing the research. And I was unfamiliar, to tell you the truth, with these various diseases that infect vines and grapes. And once I dug into it, I thought, you know, again, it was one of these things where I'd heard a little bit about it, and I, just on the basis of instinct, I decided to go ahead and pursue, you know, dig into this issue. And when I saw what was, what a large problem, you know, these grape viruses are, and bacteria, and all the all of the stuff that surrounds that, I thought I would use that as a basis for the revealing the crime, the, kind of the crime that's behind the crime. And so I know, like I said, it was a lot of fun. And I, you know, as I wrote in the book, you know, my, Dante, the journalist, research takes him to the University of California in Davis, which has the premier wine school, certainly in the country, if not one of the best in the world. And that's where a lot of the research is being done on this vine disease that that I write about in the book. And so what in discussing, you know, the story, to answer your question about why would, you know, somebody like Chao Ling give Morrison $1 million. But
yeah,
I was, I've been somewhat gratified by some of the recent books that are hit the bestseller list, like the one Crazy Rich Asians. And I thought, you know, there's a lot of Asian Americans who have a lot of money, and I've known some personally in the Bay Area who are, you know, they love wine, they and they have the resources to invest, and certainly in the Bay Area and throughout much of California, it's a status, an item of prestige to be either an owner or a partial owner in the vineyard, and so I thought, that's what I'll make my character, the victim, to be a wealthy Asian man who's, you know, kind of in love with the idea of not only wine, but owning or being a major investor or major owner in a winery. And so I thought, you know, that's, you know, becomes, you know, you were introduced to him very briefly at the opening chapter, where he's running for his life through the vineyard. And then I thought, well, say he's invested this money, but something's happened to it. The money's disappeared. And that's why there's a confrontation. And Dante Rath discovers that. And then he has to answer the question, okay, so the money's gone, so what happened to the money? And with all the other characters, or not all, but some of the secondary characters that are in the early chapters, and he follows the path, the leads that these secondary characters provide for him to answer the question as to what happened to the money. So that's, I mean, to answer your question, that's, you know, to my mind, that's why somebody like Chao Ling, who has vast resources at his disposal, putting $1 million into a vineyard was certainly something that's doable for him.
It would be nice if it was doable for anybody. Well, not doable for me.
It's not doable for me either.
No, there's a lot of other people that have their hands out, and I really don't like that. So I've got a few more questions about somebody. There was somebody named Carmen, and she's very powerful in the industry. So what role does she play? And then Dante, naughty boy, gets close to her. What's he hoping to find out? Not that I blame him, but okay. He should really behave himself, but he didn't. So how did he? Yeah, seriously, I mean, that made interest. I go, oh, you're going to get in trouble. And yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what, you know, Dante's comes across, encounters, you know, Carmen Carilli, and she's an interesting character. I thought I made her, I developed her character in such a way that I wanted to be able to bring her, keep her alive throughout the series. And I wanted to, of course, have a love interest for Dante, but I wanted somebody who's a powerful character. And so I came up with Carmen, and she is a wine country lawyer, but she also is a member of a large wine family. And so she's deeply, her background is deeply rooted in the wine business. So she definitely knows her stuff. And then combined with her law degree, she's quite a force to be reckoned with in the wine world. So that's why, I wanted to have various motivations, behind Dante. One is, of course, a romantic interest. But then two, he very much, needs her expertise and her background. And so they go out, under the pretense of having an interview or kind of a business discussion. They go out to dinner and enjoy some fine wines, and then one thing leads to another, and they're back that evening. They're back at her place, and so they enjoy each other, and then they, he wakes up in the middle of the night, and then goes while she's sleeping. Then he rifles her. Her office, and then comes across some papers on her desk which are relevant to the case he's investigating. So it's an ethical violation, of course. He doesn't do things on the up and up, but sometimes you have to, skirt around the ethical issues if you're going to pursue a story. And but anyway, he gets the information, or at least some of the information he needs, and that pushes him to continue, working on the story and exposing and developing, the story as he goes along. And I at one point I have her, she's attacked, and so I needed to, I didn't want. The reason I had that happen is I wanted to make her a sympathetic character as well as a strong female character, and I also didn't want to have her have it seem like she's part of this criminal network, that in fact she's an above the board attorney doing her best to represent her clients. And not trying to cover up any crimes, and so that's, I know that her character is a little bit more complicated, but she's going to come up. She plays an important role in the next book, which I mentioned earlier, which is going to be set in Tuscany, because I gave her an Italian background, she's an ethnic, so she's going to go back, and with Dante. to Tuscany, and she's going to be, you know, encounter her family heritage, which is back in Italy, and that's going to be their connection to, or one of the connections that puts them back in Tuscany. And of course, what I plan to do is have a a murder occur or a death occur in Tuscany that Dante gets involved in. And of course, then with Carmen, with her legal background and her family connections in Italy, it's going to make for an interesting story.
As long as you don't kill her and Dante off, we're in good shape here.
No, I
always wanted to be the bad guy in a book. So somebody actually made me the villain, and I said to her, "Are you going to bring me back?" Because I was evil, and I was very proud of that. It was a book. It's called Dead to Rights by Karen Boyne, and I'm the villain. A girl published this, and I kill off everybody that gets in my way, and I get away with it sort of at the end. And I'm just like, how could you not think that I'm wonderful? That she named me Francesca Bartoldi Lewis. It was hilarious. I always wanted to be a character in somebody's book to be evil, because it's totally not my personality. So, you know, forget it. So we have the Ling family and another character that everybody better watch out for, Mei Ling. Why does she agree to speak with Dante? And who is Jones, and why is he so negative to Dante? Poor guy, he can't win.
Oh, I mean, the editor. Yeah, he... the editor is a...
I don't like him.
Character is interesting. I've been, worked for a number of different newspapers, and managing editors, of course, come in different... shapes and sizes and temperaments that run across the board. And I, but by virtue of the position, they've, the title of managing editor implies what their primary job is, and which is to manage the, not only the sub editors, but also the reporters. And, quite often, these guys develop pretty grumpy personalities because they've heard over the years, they've heard every excuse in the book about why something didn't get done, why calls weren't made, why research wasn't done to finish out and round out a story, to verify, all the statements that are being made in the story. And so they're kind of tough. And they have to be. And but I think what I try to do with Jones is to make him not only a tough guy, but sympathetic with what Dante's trying to do. And sometimes you have to be tough with people to help them, accomplish what they really want to accomplish. And certainly that's true in the news business. Keep pushing people, demand more, make one more phone call, make one more interview, go to one more locale, check one more document, that kind of thing. And it typically pays off in the long run. For example, it brings to mind the latest stories, that expose that the New York Times did about President Trump's financial background and the reality of where he got his money and the what his father did with the money, where his father got the money, and now with Donald Jr.'s tax issues. I mean, all that kind of stuff. And that, these kind of stories are really good, but they require a lot of work and a lot of research and a lot of verification. And I had to, personally, I was gratified when the Times talked about having reviewed, 100,000 pages of documents. I thought, that's hard work, but that's good. It's like it's nailed down. You can't, this is not a story that's going to be blown away by a slight breeze. You know, it's gonna withstand some hard winds. And but anyway, and then regarding, you know, the female characters in the book, I wanted to have a quirky, interesting femme fatale, and so I made her best friends with Xiao Ling's sister, and I turned the two of them into kind of a couple, and so I wanted to have them liberal liberal with their sexuality, you might say, and they swing both ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, you know, this is fun. You know, this is an interesting character, and it's got some character's got some definite possibilities that I can use. With people that are kind of like living on the periphery of mainstream society, you know, you can do a lot with that. And that's what was fun with me with that character.
Well, before I forget, on Wednesday, I've never done this before. This is the first time I'm interviewing someone that wrote a graphic novel, Queen of Kenosha,
yeah.
Howard Shapiro. It should be interesting. The artwork is phenomenal. Now, if they would only make the print larger, I would be so much happier. On the 22nd, the book is great, though. Criminal Misdeeds, on the 25th, this is exciting. Carla Negus, Imposter's Lore. She will be here. She just confirmed again. On the 1st, Coffin, Beyond the Truth. On the 1st, none other than James Heyman, A Fatal Obsession. And one of my favorite people in the whole universe, John Land, on the 7th, Manuscript for Murder. On the 5th, Scar Tissue, Patricia Hale. On the 12th, a very sad story. The author calls himself, it's not his real name, I don't know what his name is, I Am Waiting, In My Mother's Honor. He's a Vietnam vet who's about 70-something years old that never got his benefits, so we're going to work on that. And on the 14th, Tess Gerritsen will be taking spotlight with her movie that I have to have the time to watch, and I will watch it, Island Zero, It's Scary. And on the 20th, none other than New York Times author Vincent Zandri, The Flower Man. On the 26th, a former DEA and SWAT detective will be talking about Network Exposed. And to end the month, Artie Van Wye is wrote 9/11, and he's a 9/11 survivor. And that's just November. You haven't even hit this December. And I just snagged Terry James for January 15th in January. I've got two in January and three in May. We're getting there. So here we go. Yeah, I can't believe it sometimes. So the one thing that hit me when this, when you own your own vineyard, they have to pick their own pickers. But how would they know if the wine, when the grapes are delivered, were not the real wine and they tasted different? That was what surprised me. I was saying, like, how would they know? In reality, shouldn't they know that? Or they don't, by color or texture, or do they have to actually taste it to see if they're different? Because that's what got me going, oh my God, how could they do that?
Yeah, well, that's what one of the things I was thinking about when I was researching the book.
Mm-hmm.
And something that I know a little bit about is what was interesting is that in a lot of situations, these vineyards, California vineyards, or anyway vineyards around the world, aren't necessarily the owners or even the people that live on the vineyard may not be the ones who actually do all the work. Like, all of this work is the picking, you know,
mm-hmm.
The growing of the grapes, the manicuring of the grapes, the picking of the grapes, the crushing of the grapes, all this stuff is handled by people who specialize in that. They contract with the vineyard owner to do the real work of maintaining a vineyard. And some of the vineyard owners prefer it that way because they maybe they have other businesses and they want to live They have a nice house or a beautiful estate surrounded by vineyards. And so they hire other people to do that. And that's what I wanted to, that's what gave rise to this company that Simon Grundy, who we mentioned earlier, and Bernie Morrison formed a vineyard management company. And this allows them to manipulate the business, use the grapes, play kind of a shell game with the grapes that they pick. And this is done, you know, when the grapes are ripe, maybe most people don't know this, but when the grapes are ripe, it's a very, very hectic business or very hectic time in the Napa-Sonoma Valley and that whole region of Northern California, because there's a short time frame in which the grapes have to be picked. So the pickers are going, these machines that pick the grapes, and then also the people that pick the grapes, they work around the clock, 24 hours. So there's, you know, from sunset to sunrise, they're working in the dark. And so once a giant bin of grapes is picked and labeled and loaded onto a truck, who knows where that truck may actually go. The truck may stop and unload a couple of these large, you know, giant bins of grapes at somebody else's winery that wasn't intended. And it may be replaced by grapes from a different vineyard or a different even kind of grape. And so I know there's just a lot of, you know, it's a very hectic period, but there's a lot of room for shenanigans to take place if you have some people that are managing the real work of maintaining a vineyard. If these people don't have, maybe they have a different agenda or they're being paid off. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is, too, is like there's, a lot of wines are not necessarily just a single grape wine. A lot of wines are blended. The French like to do that a lot. They're, you know, with the Bordeaux and the Burgundies, quite often they're simply not just one grape from one vineyard. It's a blend, and they'll blend different grapes, the wine from different grapes, to get the kind of flavor that they want. They want it. They don't want it too acidic. They don't want it too sweet. They don't want it, you know, like too dry tasting. They don't want it to be too fruity. So it's sometimes it's a big game is to come up with a you know, the perfect blend. You know, one of the things in my research I was found out is that in certain types of wines, the French government, of course, is so concerned about authenticity, but they have federal laws there that dictate how many different kinds of, I mean, they limit the different kinds of grapes that can be used in a blended wine. So it's very serious business. But the point being is that wines are often blended more often than not. And you know, the real prized wines, of course, are the wines that come from a single vineyard and or a single grape. That become the best, but by and large, most of the wine that people drink is actually a blend. So, I was looking back at the origins of this, you know, where all of this happens, and after the grapes are picked, and like I said earlier, there's a lot of room for some shenanigans to take place. So that's what I took advantage of that in my story to have a have some nastiness going on in the background.
So what happens if, like, he's a wine critic or a wine taster, right? So, I mean, if I tasted the same wine in two different glasses and it was, you know, one was one and one was another, I might be able to tell that it's different. The taste might taste different a little bit. But when you have the grapes and they tamper with them, whatever, would a real wine taster know? Shouldn't they know that something was wrong? Wouldn't they know from the aroma, the taste, the body, that it was wrong? Or wouldn't they know?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, you're absolutely right. That's a very good question. I'm, you know, there's, you know, to become a sommelier requires mm-hmm. quite a bit of work and research and mm-hmm. practice. And that's exactly what people have to do. They have to train themselves or educate themselves by mm-hmm. by sipping, smelling, tasting, looking at, mm-hmm. you know, sniffing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of wines. And and then that's, of course, how you're tested. You know, you have to test wines, or you're given, you know, blindfolded, and you're given, you know, glasses of wine, and you have to taste them and then determine, you know, where they come from. You know, and it's very possible, obviously, if you spend a lot of time doing that and training yourself and remembering, okay, this wine is, this has a particular aroma, like you said, a you know, the body's a little mm-hmm. thicker, it's got a darker color or lighter color or whatever. It's very possible. But, you know, for certainly, yes, that would happen. But on, but for my purposes, you know, the vast, vast majority of people certainly don't have tastes that are that sophisticated. So, you know, you know, I even myself, you know, I enjoy wine, but and I can tell a difference between a certainly a Pinot Noir or in a Burgundy or a Zinfandel and that kind of thing. And I can taste the difference between, yeah, I know whether a wine is from California or not because of the style and flavor, mm-hmm. whether European wine or Italian wines. You know, I'm certainly don't, you know, consider myself a sophisticate in terms of that at all. I just enjoy wine. I enjoy the flavor of wine, and that's about it. And so to answer your question, certainly the real sommeliers and certainly the master sommeliers would be able to pick out probably, you know, because of their experience, you know, whether or not a wine is a single grape wine or a blend, and they could probably tell you, you know, different varieties that might be in it. You know, as long as we're not talking like 10 or 15 different wines, if you're talking about two or three blends, mm-hmm. Sure, they could certainly pick it out.
Well, I can tell you about coffee and caffeine. And I can tell you
okay,
the different real blends of coffee that you know, I can tell the difference. I mean, I love one, but it's two particular blends of Javaya, and I love them. I can tell the difference. Uh-huh. One is stronger than the other. But the other day, I tried decaf, two of them, and I go like, that's not going to work. It just doesn't taste right. Doesn't taste the same. It's bitter. It's this. It's that. And if you don't have any caffeine, what good is it in the world? And I don't care if I'm not supposed to drink it. It doesn't really matter. So I've got a couple more questions. By the way, everybody, just so you remember, in December, I haven't picked who yet, just review, since I am pretty famous for some reason. I don't know why, but I am. Just Reviews is a sanctioned review site. I am in the yellow pages of book reviewers, believe it or not. I don't know, yeah. And in the indie pages of book reviewers and a whole lot of other places that I don't even know I'm at. And, yeah, and all over the world somehow they know me. I have no clue how, but that's okay. Just Reviews will be designing on – last year I said it was going to be 10, but I can't count anymore. So probably the 15 top books of the year, I will announce them on my last show on December 20th, which is with, New York Times author Stephen James, Every Wicked Man. That was like, I didn't expect to get him. I was like, oh, my God, yes, okay, this is great. So I have a few more questions. The intricacies of this industry are described as what drives the plot forward, but Dante won't stop. And when he goes to the feds, why do they stonewall him at first? And I didn't like that at all.
Yeah, well, I think I hate to say it, but I think sometimes the investigators don't, you know, I think, you know, like having been a police reporter, I know that different criminal investigative agencies are inundated with requests to investigate, and they have to go through a sorting process, and so quite often they're reluctant to jump into things. I mean, as we've seen with just recently with the Kavanaugh confirmation, the request, you know, that floated from congressional members of Congress to the FBI that they investigate, and the FBI, you know, was dragging its feet. And to some extent, I can understand. I mean, they need to have a you know, evidence that a crime has been committed, and then secondly, it has to the crime that the accusation that a crime has been committed has to fall within their purview of what they investigate. And so I can see. I mean, there's a lot of with the Kavanaugh thing and the FBI. There was a lot. There were a lot of different forces at play there, pushing back and forth. But, you know, I think, you know, the reluctance that the feds show to just jump into a case, I think, is quite typical. They have to move carefully and judiciously. And, you know, there's also a factor of that I think a lot of people might look at crime and wine country as to, you know, these aren't, these crimes don't happen to people who are underdogs. You know, they have, they typically have, you know, money, influence, and power. And to some extent, I think some of these investigators kind of will hear about a crime and shrug their shoulders and say, so what? You know, who really got hurt here? And so it's frustrating. You know, I share your frustration, but that's one of the reasons I threw that in there is that I wanted to have a reluctant bureaucracy, I guess. Secondly, it also allows. It's almost like it gives, you know, Dante a little bit more freedom. And to pursue something, knowing that he's on his own, but also I think it adds to it elevates the nobility of his cause. You know, like nobody else is going to pick up the thread on this. So Dante gets to be more of a hero.
So wait, before we go, we have about 3 minutes left. where can everybody learn more about you and your work? And I just texted my nephew. My nephew is into baseball, but he's also into journalism, and he writes very well. And I just said, oh, I'm interviewing a journalist. And he said, oh, really? Are you really? my husband knows what I do. My family doesn't know what I do. And they've never listened to my radio show, which is really sad because they might learn something, like, you know, read a book or something. So you know, my nephew was like, he was impressed. Jake got impressed. I said, okay, good. Now go to class and get A's like your aunt. But where can we find out more about you and your work? And I hope to get the next book before it comes out. That's just it.
Okay, I'll, you know, I have a website. It's petereichstead.com. And I think if people go, the easy way to get there is just, you know, look up the book Napa Noir or type in my name on Amazon, and it'll take you to my books. Like, you can also go to my Amazon page there, and that'll link you to my my own website where all of my books are there. And then, of course, my background. But like I said, I come from a journalistic background, but I've always loved murder mysteries. I've loved, I like the classics, you know, John D. McDonald, Dashiell Hammett, James M. Cain. I've always liked the noir genre, and you know, I like the main characters, and that's what I've always liked. There's something an idea I had in the back of my mind for a long time was that, you know, I kept thinking as I read these, you know, murder mysteries and noir stories, I always thought, I said, well, journalists, you know, good investigative reporters do a lot of the same kind of things that private eyes do. And so that's why it was very easy for me to, instead of having a private eye as a main character, to have a journalist. And I was able to, with a journalist, you have a built-in, you know, cadre of characters, like a managing editor. You have other people in the newsroom that you can bounce off your ideas, and as well as you know, the people that you're investigating, you encounter in the way along the way. So that's why I, you know, I was able to tap into my own personal background as well as take advantage of, you know, a genre that I've always liked, you know, for, you know, many, many decades now.
Well, I want to thank you very much. And everybody, it's raining outside, but we'll get over it. It's going to be a beautiful day tomorrow eventually. And it's really nice here. It's, let's see how much the temperature is this time. It's 59 degrees in Upper Westchester, whereas tomorrow it's going to be 40 degrees in Upper Westchester. As long as it's not snowing, I'm very happy. I want to thank you so very much. This is interesting, and it taught me a lot, let me tell you. So thank you very much, Peter. Everybody have a great day.
Yeah, you too.
And bye.
I appreciate it.
I sent you the link for the show, too. Okay.
Okay, bye. Thanks a lot. I appreciate that.